their brain and the crowd that will walk on it. According to the artist's post on Instagram, the idea is to find a place perfectly reproducing the Eiffel Tower and have fun taking pictures by the imaginary cliff or jumping over the gaping chasm.
In Thailand, three sniffer dogs have joined the fight against the third wave of the pandemic in the country. The canines sniff hundreds of sweat samples per day to detect COVID patients who display no symptoms. The samples are from local medical volunteers as well as bedridden patients who are not able to show up at testing centers. Thailand's Social Development and Human Security Ministry is in charge of collecting the samples and delivering them to a university in Bangkok where the dogs operate. Researchers say the dogs can detect a volatile compound secreted in the sweat of COVID-infected people.
The distinctive scent is what would appear after there's an infection. Different kinds of viruses will produce different kinds of scents, therefore they contain different smells. The canines are very sensitive towards scents excreted from human body, and they have better scents by hundreds of millions of times better than us humans, without even having to come into close contact with the virus.
Researchers say the dogs have a success rate of over 90% in detecting asymptomatic COVID patients. They say the canines have gone through thousands of samples since early May.
Robots probably will never replace humans, but you must be worried they might steal your job in the future. A cook robot in Spain has risen to fame because of its ability to prepare paella, one of the world's most renowned national dishes. This robot is made up of an electronically controlled stove and a mechanical arm. It can put the already fried ingredients into the pan, add rice to it, and then stir it before pouring in the fish stock. The robot can prepare one paella at a time. However, all the ingredients have to be prepared and measured in advance. The Spanish company behind this product is trying to expand the robot's functionality.
They are designing what we have named Gastro Robot Menu, a robot gastronomic experience. Five chefs from the Basque Culinary Center are developing a five-course menu, so eventually we would take a seat in front of the robot and taste five courses designed by five important chefs.
Enrique says the product has already provoked interest outside Spain. He says some amusement parks and resorts in Japan already have their own paella robots. Paella masters believe the machine is a useful tool for chefs because they can cook many paellas at the same time. As the world continues to battle COVID-19, people are finding traditional and modern ways of remembering those who have lost their lives due to the pandemic. A public library in the U.S. is commemorating the victims with an origami project. The Greenpoint Public Library in Brooklyn, New York City, has collected 1,000 origami pieces since April. Inspired by the ancient Japanese legend that 1,000 paper cranes can bring well wishes or healing, the library aims to promote hope and a sense of solidarity. The delicate handmade cranes, many of them from recycled paper, are now on display in the library's lobby. The staff hopes that each and every crane brings hope to the community.
We made this for the COVID Remembrance Day event, month-long event. Crane, in many cultures, especially in Asian culture, it symbolizes peace, love, recovery, and hope. And especially in Japanese culture, Senbutsu, 1,000 paper crane, is really significant. They believe that if one holds 1,000 paper crane, one's wishes come true.
The library has also asked people to come by and drop off their homemade origami as a memorial to the COVID-19 victims. It plans to keep up the display until at least the end of the summer.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Senate Republicans have signaled disappointment in the White House's updated infrastructure bill since it was offered on Friday, 21st of May, and negotiations appear to be at a standstill despite the $550 billion cut in funding size. The article you're about to hear has been taken from the website usnews.com and written by reporter and journalist Elliot Davis. The piece is titled Republicans' White House at Impasse Over Infrastructure Bill. Senate Republicans have signaled disappointment in the White House's updated infrastructure bill since it was offered on Friday, 21st of May, and negotiations appear to be at a standstill despite the $550 billion cut in funding size. The two sides even seem further apart now than they were when negotiations began, according to a statement reported by the Associated Press from an aide to Senator Shelley Moore Capito of West Virginia, who is leading discussions on the Republican side. President Joe Biden and other senior officials have met with a group of Republican senators several times in recent weeks, both at the White House and on Capitol Hill. While full details on the updated package, which has been reduced in size from $2.25 trillion to $1.7 trillion, have not yet been made public by the Biden administration. White House Press Secretary, though, Jen Psaki, has described the bill's trimming as mainly being focused on research and development, broadband, and funding for bridges, roads, and other major projects to come closer to the number proposed by the senators. A White House memo obtained by the Associated Press notes that the cut of research and development funds alone account for $480 billion of the $550 billion total removed from the proposal. In our view, this is the act, the art, I should say, of seeking common ground, Jen Psaki said during a Friday press briefing. She added, this proposal exhibits a willingness to come down in size, giving on some areas that are important to the president, otherwise they wouldn't have been in the proposal, while also staying firm in areas that are most vital to rebuilding our infrastructure. The differences appear to be about the two sides' definition of infrastructure rather than the total cost of the bill. Our biggest gap is defining what infrastructure is, GOP Senator Roy Blunt of Missouri said during a Fox News Sunday interview over the weekend. Republican Senator Roy Blunt added, if we get to a definition of infrastructure that the country would have always accepted, that becomes a much narrower space than it appears to be right now. The two sides also remain at odds over how the massive proposal will be paid for. Republicans have reportedly floated paying for the package through user fees, such as a gas tax. But White House spokeswoman Jen Psaki said on Friday that President Biden is not willing to raise taxes on Americans earning under $400,000 a year through such fees. But Republicans also remain opposed to the tax hikes associated with the White House proposal, with Senate GOP leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky saying during a Thursday Fox Business interview that his side is going to fight it the whole way. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said during a press briefing last week that while she would not expect the bill to be on the floor before Memorial Day, the administration's hope is that we will have a better sense on the path forward and what the opportunity is looking ahead, right before or around the holiday. With talks seemingly at an impasse, it is difficult to predict what progress will look like in a week's time. But GOP Senator Roy Blunt of Missouri said during his Sunday television interview that he thinks the two sides have a week or 10 days to decide if we can work together on this or not. At least some Democrats are pushing President Biden to push forward without the support of his counterparts. Despite President Biden's efforts to engage with Republicans, they have shown no willingness whatsoever to negotiate in good faith with Democrats to confront the intersecting crises we face, Senator Ed Markey of Massachusetts said in a statement on Friday. He added, voters, cross-party lines, support President Biden's vision and the American job and family plans. Let's not waste time trading the necessary scope and scale of this critical infrastructure package for congressional Republican votes that have yet to and will never materialize. The Biden administration has signaled that it is ready to move on when and if it's necessary. President Biden wants a deal and he wants it soon. There are meaningful negotiations taking place in a bipartisan manner. He's willing to let that play out, Cedric Richmond, a White House senior advisor and director of the Office of Public Engagement, said during a Sunday television appearance on CNN. Cedric Richmond added, but again, he will not let inaction be the answer, and when he gets to the point where it looks like that is inevitable, you'll see him change course.
live.
Iran held its first presidential election in less than a year after the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution on the 25th of January 1980. Abul Hassan Bani Sadr was elected as the country's first ever president after securing over 75% of the votes. Iran's first presidential election was held with the participation of more than 14 million people. The presidency of Bani Sadr ended after he was impeached by Parliament in June 1981. With a landslide victory, former Prime Minister Mohammad Ali Rajai replaced Bani Sadr. However, Rajai's presidency did not last long. He was assassinated, along with Prime Minister Mohammad Javad Bahonar, in a bomb blast on the 30th of August 1981. Rajai's assassination resulted in another early election. This time, Iran's leader Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, then a member of parliament, became the third president of the country with more than 95% of the votes. Ayatollah Khamenei was re-elected in 1985 with another overwhelming victory. His presidency coincided with the war Iraq imposed on Iran. During his last weeks in office, the founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini, passed away. Ayatollah Khamenei was then chosen as the country's leader by the Assembly of Experts on the 4th of June 1989. In Iran's fifth presidential election, influential politician and parliament speaker Akbar Hashemi Rafsanjani was elected with more than 15 million votes. In 1993, Rafsanjani was re-elected with a wide margin. However, the general turnout that year was relatively low. Rafsanjani's eight-year presidency is known as the construction period, mainly due to his administration's economic reforms. The voter turnout reached a record high in Iran's seventh presidential election, when nearly 80% of the voting eligible population cast their ballots. Reformist candidate Mohammad Khatami became Iran's president with nearly 70% of the votes. Khatami was re-elected in 2001 for a second term, following another high voter turnout. Iran's ninth presidential election was the first in history to go into a runoff after none of the seven candidates secured the 50% needed majority in the country's closest ever presidential race. Former President Akbar Hashemi Rafsanjani and Tehran Mayor Mahmoud Ahmadinejad went into the second round. The runoff led to Ahmadinejad's victory. In 2009, incumbent President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was re-elected with 24 million votes. This year recorded the highest percentage of voter turnout in the country's history of presidential elections. However, the final result of the election drew objections over what some claimed was election fraud. The allegations were, however, rejected by the country's supervisory bodies, and Ahmadinejad stayed in office as president. Hassan Rouhani became Iran's next president. He served for two terms after victories in the 2013 and the 2017 presidential races. With 50% and 57% majority votes, the reformist-backed president won the country's top executive post in two consecutive elections that witnessed passionate public participation. Who will be the winner of Iran's 13th presidential election? That is a decision Iranians will make on the 18th of June.
The recent Israeli aggression against the besieged Gaza Strip began on May 10th, after the Israeli regime attacked worshippers in Al-Aqsa Mosque and started eviction plans of the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in the occupied East Jerusalem Al-Quds. This wasn't the first time the besieged territory came under Israeli fire. However, this time Palestinians turned the tables against the regime and launched unprecedented rocket and drone attacks on Israeli cities, inflicting damage and casualties on the enemy. Finally, after 11 days of brutal Israeli attacks that killed at least 279 Palestinians, including 69 children, the occupying regime announced a unilateral ceasefire on Friday, which was accepted by Palestinian resistance groups with Egyptian mediation. People in the besieged Gaza Strip and the occupied West Bank hailed the truce as a victory for Palestinian resistance groups in the face of Israel's attacks. The 11-day-long Israeli aggression resulted in the displacement of over 90,000 Gazans and the destruction of Gaza's critical infrastructure and many civilian buildings. International NGOs and Gaza officials say several hospitals and schools, as well as power and sewage plants, have been severely damaged. The Red Cross says that Gaza could take years to rebuild. Moreover, Palestinian lawyers say the Israeli army's use of live fire and rubber-coated bullets from short range against Palestinian demonstrators is a war crime. Meanwhile, Palestinian Foreign Minister Riyad al-Maliki has sent a letter to the International Criminal Court's prosecutor's office, including documents on new and ongoing crimes, calling for an investigation into Israel's war crimes in Gaza, West Bank, and Jerusalem al-Quds.
I think that now, following the horrific damage that Israel did, wherein it targeted homes, medical centers, press buildings, these are all in blatant violation of international law. And much as Israel would like to say that Hamas had some presence there, there is no evidence to support that. So I think this time, with an investigation about to begin regarding possible war crimes that Israel committed in 2014, I do believe that these will be added to it.
Following a ceasefire between Tel Aviv and Palestinian resistance groups, after 11 days of Israel's deadly war on the Gaza Strip, Hamas and the military wing of the Islamic Jihad movement, Al-Quds Brigades, thanked Iran for its unwavering support for the Palestinian resistance, saying Iran is a partner in the victory against Israel. Iran's leader, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, congratulated Palestinians for their victory against Israel. Ayatollah Khamenei noted that Palestinians' resistance left the Zionist regime with no choice but to request a ceasefire.
The regime's defeat was manifested both in its continued crimes and its request for a ceasefire. The Israeli regime was forced to concede defeat.
The Iranian leader noted that the Israeli regime will get weaker than what it is today, while the preparedness of resistance forces will make Palestine stronger day by day. He also called on the entire Muslim nations to feel responsible for the Palestinian cause.
Muslim governments should enter the scene with sincerity to support the Palestinian nation, whether by boosting their military might or lending financial support. This is required more than ever before for the reconstruction of the infrastructure and repairing the damage done to Gaza.
Ayatollah Khamenei emphasized that the crimes Israel committed during its latest onslaught should not be left unpunished. He said Israeli authorities, particularly Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, must be brought to justice in independent international tribunals.
The defeat will indirectly do that, because the Israeli government has seen that it no longer has the level of support around the world that it once believed it had. People spoke up in the streets. There were mass demonstrations in support of Palestine around the world. Many governments, although they were critical of Hamas, unjustly critical, they were also critical of Israel. This is new. Israel no longer can do whatever it wants with complete impunity.
Israel launched an offensive on the Gaza Strip and approved a ceasefire without any preconditions or strategic breakthrough. This means the Palestinian resistance has taught Israelis an important lesson, and that is the Israeli enemy is incapable of facing Palestine's united uprising. The recent Israeli aggression against the besieged Gaza Strip began on May 10th, after the Israeli regime attacked worshippers in Al-Aqsa Mosque and started eviction plans of the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in the occupied East Jerusalem Al-Quds. This wasn't the first time the besieged territory came under Israeli fire. However, this time Palestinians turned the tables against the regime and launched unprecedented rocket and drone attacks on Israeli cities, inflicting damage and casualties on the enemy. Finally, after 11 days of brutal Israeli attacks that killed at least 279 Palestinians, including 69 children, the occupying regime announced a unilateral ceasefire on Friday, which was accepted by Palestinian resistance groups with Egyptian mediation. People in the besieged Gaza Strip and the occupied West Bank hailed the truce as a victory for Palestinian resistance groups in the face of Israel's attacks. The 11-day-long Israeli aggression resulted in the displacement of over 90,000 Gazans and the destruction of Gaza's critical infrastructure and many civilian buildings. International NGOs and Gaza officials say several hospitals and schools, as well as power and sewage plants, have been severely damaged. The Red Cross says that Gaza could take years to rebuild. Moreover, Palestinian lawyers say the Israeli army's use of live fire and rubber-coated bullets from short range against Palestinian demonstrators is a war crime. Meanwhile, Palestinian Foreign Minister Riyad al-Maliki has sent a letter to the International Criminal Court's prosecutor's office, including documents on new and ongoing crimes, calling for an investigation into Israel's war crimes in Gaza, West Bank, and Jerusalem al-Quds.
I think that now, following the horrific damage that Israel did, wherein it targeted homes, medical centers, press buildings, these are all in blatant violation of international law. And much as Israel liked to say that Hamas had some presence there, there is no evidence to support that. So I think this time, with an investigation about to begin regarding possible war crimes that Israel committed in 2014, I do believe that these will be added to it.
Following a ceasefire between Tel Aviv and Palestinian resistance groups, after 11 days of Israel's deadly war on the Gaza Strip, Hamas and the military wing of the Islamic Jihad movement, Al-Quds Brigades, thanked Iran for its unwavering support for the Palestinian resistance, saying Iran is a partner in the victory against Israel. Iran's leader, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, congratulated Palestinians for their victory against Israel. Ayatollah Khamenei noted that Palestinians' resistance left the Zionist regime with no choice but to request a ceasefire.
The regime's defeat was manifested both in its continued crimes and its request for a ceasefire. The Israeli regime was forced to concede defeat.
The Iranian leader noted that the Israeli regime will get weaker than what it is today, while the preparedness of resistance forces will make Palestine stronger day by day. He also called on the entire Muslim nations to feel responsible for the Palestinian cause.
Muslim governments should enter the scene with sincerity to support the Palestinian nation, whether by boosting their military might or lending financial support. This is required more than ever before for the reconstruction of the infrastructure and repairing the damage done to Gaza.
Ayatollah Khamenei emphasized that the crimes Israel committed during its latest onslaught should not be left unpunished. He said Israeli authorities, particularly Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, must be brought to justice in independent international tribunals.
The defeat will indirectly do that, because Israel has seen, the Israeli government has seen, that it no longer has the level of support around the world that it once believed it had. People spoke up in the streets. There were mass demonstrations in support of Palestine around the world. Many governments, although they were critical of Hamas, unjustly critical, they were also critical of Israel. This is new. Israel no longer can do whatever it wants with complete impunity.
Israel launched an offensive on the Gaza Strip and approved a ceasefire without any preconditions or strategic breakthrough. This means the Palestinian resistance has taught Israelis an important lesson, and that is, the Israeli enemy is incapable of facing Palestine's united uprising.
Palestinians have poured to the streets to celebrate their victory over Israel in the 11-day fighting between the two sides. Rallies were held across the besieged Gaza Strip in condemnation of the Israeli regime and celebration of its defeat. Gatherings were also held in the occupied West Bank, where joyful participants cheered for the victory for the resistance. The celebrations came after an Egypt-brokered ceasefire went to effect on Friday morning, ending the fiercest battle there in years. This wasn't the first time the besieged territory came under Israeli fire, but this time, Palestinians turned the tables against the regime and launched unprecedented rocket and drone attacks on Israeli cities, inflicting damage and casualties on the enemy. Experts believe that Israel has succumbed to the unprecedented response by the Palestinian resistance and agreed to the ceasefire without any preconditions.
I think it's a huge win. The fact is that never before have we seen Israel penetrated militarily, psychologically, and morally in this way before. The sheer numbers of Palestinian resistance missiles that actually penetrated the Iron Dome is absolutely incredible. This much-vaunted dome, which was meant to protect the Israeli civilians, essentially collapsed because, my estimation, is around 30% of the missiles got through. And what were these missiles? Essentially, they were just homemade rockets. Not only that, what we've seen is that this, for the first time, turned into an insurrection within occupied Palestinian territory. Within the colony itself, they call Israel, you saw huge numbers of Palestinians demonstrating and rising up, and actually huge clashes took place. A lot of that would have been suppressed.
People across the world have shown their solidarity with Palestinians in the past few days. In the United States, protesters called for the cessation of all funding to Israel. As the Israeli regime was targeting the people of Palestine, the U.S. administration approved the sale of $735 million in precision-guided weapons to the Israeli regime. The arms deal is now pending the approval of Congress. Several American congresspeople, including Senator Bernie Sanders and House Representatives Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Mark Pocan, and Rashida Tlaib, objected to the plan and introduced motions to block the sales. But given the traditionally strong support for Israel in the Congress, the motions will almost certainly fail.
The U.S. is totally $3.5 billion per annum is donated by Israel to by America to Israel in order to sustain its arms industry. As the bombs were falling Palestinian children, you found that Joe Biden cleared $750 million of aid for arms and missiles to Israel. So that was the initial response of America.
In the meantime, U.S. President Joe Biden has welcomed the ceasefire, expressing hope that it would hold. He, however, reaffirmed the U.S. support for the Israeli regime. Several Israeli political and military figures have questioned Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's motives for launching the offensive on the Gaza Strip and approving a ceasefire without any strategic breakthrough for the regime. Netanyahu's political opponents speculate that the premier ordered the strikes after he failed to establish a coalition cabinet to put an end to Israel's political stalemate. But the developments over the past 2 weeks have shown that the next time the regime ventures an offensive against Gaza, it could face consequences more serious than a political vacuum in Tel Aviv.
This is IRIB English Radio. Thank you. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Voter suppression bill currently being considered by the Texas legislature would decrease the number of polling locations in districts that are traditionally Democratic and non-white, while increasing the locations in Republican and predominantly white districts. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Sharon Jung Ryder. This article is published under the heading, New Texas Bill Reduces Polling Locations in Blue and Non-White Districts. Stay tuned for the details, please. Voter suppression will currently being considered by the Texas legislature would decrease the number of polling locations in districts that are traditionally Democratic and non-white, while increasing the locations in Republican and predominantly white districts. Now Republicans are targeting those very places in an elections bill. SB 7, applying a formula to redistribute polling locations in the state's five most populous counties that the Texas Tribune has found would disproportionately affect voters in Democratic communities. In Harris County, which houses Houston, all but two of the area's 15 Democratic districts would see a decrease in polling locations thanks to the new formula. District 141, which is also home to the largest portion of non-white people of voting age of any other district in the county, white people make up only 10.6% of the population of voting age there, would be hit the hardest, losing 11 polling places. All of the districts in Harris County that would be losing polling places are represented by the Democrats. Meanwhile, every district represented by a Republican would either not see a change or would gain polling locations. All of those districts have white voting age populations of 45% or more, according to census data. The Texas Tribune analysis also finds similar trends in other counties. In Tarrant County's District 90, which is represented by a Democrat and where 77% of the population is either Latino or Black, voters would lose half of the polling locations they had in 2020. SB 7 would also implement a number of other voting restrictions, such as limiting the distribution of absentee ballots, allowing for more voter roll purges, and limiting early voting with provisions like banning drive-through voting. The bill, if signed into law, would make Texas one of the hardest states in the county for citizens to exercise their right to vote.
State lawmakers are currently ironing out the final details of the bill, after which it will have to clear a vote again in the Senate and the House. The GOP controls both chambers of the legislature and the governor. Greg Abbott is a Republican. Though the election bill will affect millions of voters in the state, Republicans have shrouded the process of writing and amending the bill in secrecy. The committee currently making amendments to the bill is doing so behind closed doors, much to the dismay of many voting rights advocates. Republican Representative Briscoe Cain also previously tried to rush the voting restriction bill out of committee without listing it on the committee's agenda, giving journalists no notice of the bill's movement and the public no chance to comment on it. Cain has said that the bill isn't about voter suppression in his opinion. "I believe it is voter enhancement," he said this month of the bill, "that would make it harder for people of color to vote." The bill, which Cain has sponsored, also has language plucked straight out of Jim Crow, including phrases that suggest it is necessary to preserve the purity of the ballot box. Republicans have been quite open with their goals in this year's wave of voter suppression laws. They are trying to engineer situations so that Republicans can't lose elections again. In March, an Arizona lawmaker said that the GOP is passing such laws because everybody shouldn't be voting. The GOP has been passing voter suppression laws at record pace, introducing hundreds over the course of just a few months. Democrats, both at the Senate and federal level, have been trying to stem the tide, but Republicans are forging ahead, especially in states where they control the governorship and the legislature. Before the Texas House passed a version of SB 7 earlier this month, Democrats fought the legislation through the night, introducing 130 amendments to the bill. And at the federal level, Democrats are trying to pass the Four People Act, which would drastically expand voting access, but the Senate filibuster stands in its way.
Around the World with Reporters.
Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah gave a televised speech to commemorate the 21st anniversary of the liberation of South Lebanon from the Israeli occupation. May 25, 2000 represents, as Said Nasrallah noted, the beginning of an era of victories for the resistance in the region. The most significant stance in this year's speech was a warning to the Israelis to keep their hands off Al-Quds and Muslim and Christian holy sites in Palestine.
"The resistance in Gaza created a balance where they said any assault on Al-Aqsa Mosque and Al-Quds will lead to a military confrontation. The new equation that we need to reach is that if they touch Al-Quds, then there will be a regional war. This means all the resistance movements in the region cannot stand idly by if the holy city and the sanctities are under genuine threat. This is a genuine promise that the people of the resistance in the entire region will not forsake the holy city or the Muslim and Christian holy sites to be destroyed."
The leader of the resistance in Lebanon gave a detailed explanation of why the latest confrontation was exceptional and why its results yielded a victory for the Palestinians and a defeat for the Israelis. Experts believe the many victories for the resistance in Palestine are part of the era of triumph which began in May of 2000.
بدأت عام 2000.
All the past wars and victories from 2000 to 2006 in Lebanon to 2008 in Gaza until the last battle were all evidence of the accumulation of achievements for victory of the resistance. Today in Gaza in 2021, we saw the peak of the accumulated victories and the failure which is lived by the Israelis. The resistance was able to unite all the Palestinian people, and that victory was an extension of the victories in Lebanon. Now the Palestinian resistance is at the heart of the resistance front in the region, enforcing new realities.
The Lebanese celebrate May 25th as a national holiday, though the last Israeli soldier left South Lebanon on May 25th, 2000, signaling an end to over 18 years of invasions and occupation of Lebanon. The Lebanese official stance considers the Sheba Farms and Kfar Shuba Hills as Lebanese territory that should be liberated.
Celebration of Liberation Day this year in Lebanon has become intertwined with the victory in Palestine, while Lebanese recall that years of sacrifice and resistance against Israeli occupation led to liberty. They believe it is their duty to motivate the Palestinians to continue on that same path until they reach complete freedom. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
The remaining signatories of the nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, enter into a fifth round of talks aimed at reviving the agreement through the removal of U.S. sanctions and a return to full compliance by Iran.
The experts will continue the discussions in the working groups. In the meantime, the European Union, as coordinator, will continue the talks with all participants of the JCPOA and separately with the United States in view of finding common grounds for an agreement to take shape.
Iranian lead delegate Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi said the difficult issues that still need to be resolved have become less, although decisions must be made on the remaining differences.
We have made some progress on them, but we are not still in a position to say that we have a clear answer for them and a clear solution actually for these key issues. But I'm confident that we would be able to make progress this time and, if possible, conclude the negotiations, which I have to repeat, I'm not confident that it would be possible to conclude the negotiations, but there is the possibility.
Iran has been demanding the removal of all U.S. sanctions, including those imposed under other labels against individuals and entities under the former administration of Donald Trump. Iran has also made it clear it would only come back to full compliance after it has verified the effective removal of sanctions, demands that up until now have not been met. Araghchi says he's seen determination and seriousness by all parties involved to reach a conclusion in the coming days, a prospect that he admits is still not by any means certain. Homolesky, Vienna.
The UK Home Office is under the spotlight once more after Home Secretary Priti Patel oversaw an immigration raid under the guise of observing the implementation of the law, but which nonetheless outraged many.
There are other ways to uphold the rule of law and the practices and policies and rules and regulations of any government without sensationalising the misery of you know, people who are extremely marginalised, excluded, and many of which have, you know, travelled an awful long way to seek the safety and international protection of the United Kingdom.
In Scotland, despite hundreds turning out to prevent a similar immigration bust, Priti Patel reiterated that she believed British people supported and voted for such scenes.
The Home Secretary is completely delusional. I don't think there was ever a vote that said, do you agree to people being rounded up like cattle, denied their right to appeal, denied an opportunity for their family members to be informed that they have been rounded up, and to be deported or administratively removed from the United Kingdom.
The Windrush scandal also continues as part of the hostile environment to affect many people.
There are one and two and three generations of people being denied services, people being denied access to university places, people not being able to access medical treatments, denied opportunities to access social housing, and it is an absolute blight on this government.
Many people think that modern Britain is simply a far cry from the welcoming image which is often presented to the world.
The hostile environment created by the UK government continues to have a devastating impact on communities, with legal experts concerned about many cases of unlawful detainment and deportation. Richard Sudan, London.
As anti-racism activists, Black Lives Matter demonstrators, and U.S. officials mark the killing of George Floyd with memorial events and marches around the country, the members of the victim's family met with President Joe Biden. In New York, civil rights activist Reverend Al Sharpton and several other officials, including the city's mayor Bill de Blasio, gathered and kneeled in a symbolic move to remember the black man's murder.
As we want to dramatize to the world the insensitivity and outright total lack of any concern that this officer had, he put his knee on the neck of George Floyd for 9 minutes and 29 seconds. And you've got to have a lot of disregard for the law, disregard for human being, to have something throbbing under you that long.
During the memorial, de Blasio slammed the persistent U.S. police brutality and racism.
How do you forget someone's humanity? Well, because for 400 years in this country, the persistent, obsessive training was to tell white people not to value black lives. It was everywhere you turned. And it poisoned the mind of that officer. What he did disgusts me to this hour of this day.
More than 150 years after the 13th Amendment abolished slavery in the U.S., opinion polls show most American adults believe the legacy of slavery continues to have an impact on the position of black people in society. Following the murder of Floyd, Americans and people around the world ramped up calls to root out law enforcement misconduct and violence against black people. After a year, the divided U.S. Congress still struggles to find a compromise to pass a federal bill in response to the ongoing controversial methods of policing. The 46-year-old Floyd was killed in Minneapolis by white former officer Derek Chauvin, who was convicted last month of murder. While the conviction of Chauvin, who faces up to 40 years in prison, marked a new chapter in the U.S., incidents of similar nature have nevertheless persisted in the country ever since. A year after the brutal murder, activists say measures taken by some jurisdictions, which have been on the books for years, are insufficient to address the issue of systematic racism in the U.S. criminal justice system.
Yemeni people and government officials headed to Hamas office in Yemen's capital Sana'a to extend their congratulations to Palestinians for their historic victory over the Israeli regime and to express solidarity with Palestinians against any new Israeli aggression.
We in the Hamas movement live here among our Yemeni brothers who share with us the joy of victory, and this is something expected from the Yemeni people. This victory was achieved thanks to God and thanks to the efforts of the brothers in the resistance axis, including Yemenis. We share the same goal and vision with the Yemeni people, who made the issue of Palestine one of their top priorities despite being involved in a deadly war by Saudi Arabia and its allies.
The Yemenis called on the Palestinian resistance to continue its armed struggle against Israel. They also thanked Iran for its open support for Palestinian resistance groups.
We came here to congratulate our Palestinian brothers on this great victory that delighted the Yemenis and all the free people of the world. This victory was clinched with the blessing of God and the great support of Iran, and it was a confirmation of our unified stance against our common enemy Israel, who was defeated in this battle. The resistance groups must continue their armed struggle until the liberation of all occupied lands.
Israel killed hundreds of civilians, including women and children, in its war on Gaza and its deadly crackdown on Palestinians on the occupied West Bank earlier this month. Palestinian resistance groups responded by hitting the Israeli-occupied territories with hundreds of rockets, which forced the regime to declare a unilateral ceasefire.
Yemenis say the ongoing Saudi war on their country taught them that armed struggle is the only way to stand against aggressors. They believe that Palestinians are on the right path to regaining their territories from the Israeli occupation. Abdul Latif Al Washali, Sana'a.
Israeli forces have escalated their arrest campaigns throughout the occupied territories as a fragile ceasefire halts in the besieged Gaza Strip following an 11-day Israeli airstrikes on the enclave. Tens of Palestinians were detained by Israeli forces in raids across the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem Al-Quds early Monday. The Palestinian Prisoner Club Association expects more arrests to be reported within the coming days.
Israel's occupation project has not ended yet. These arrests are aimed at draining the energy of the Palestinian people who are determined to resist Israel. The Israeli authorities think that by adopting aggressive measures, they can refrain the consciousness of the Palestinian people.
Over the past days, Israeli forces have arrested hundreds of Palestinians in lands occupied in 1948. Moreover, the Israeli police announced it arrested 1,550 Palestinians in the past 2 weeks in areas such Haifa, Yaffa, Lod, Ramli, and Kfar Kanna, towns in occupied lands amid tension over Israeli attacks on the Gaza Strip. These areas have witnessed the protests against Israeli aggression on Palestinians in East Jerusalem, Al-Quds, and the Gaza Strip. These protests have been attacked by both the Israeli police and settlers, and many of the Palestinians' shops and vehicles have been smashed.
Israel tries to oppress the Palestinians through arresting them so that they can't remain united in their resistance against the Israeli occupation.
Tension escalated across the Palestinian territories since last month over Israel's attempt to ethnically cleanse Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in Jerusalem Al-Quds from Palestinian families in favor of settlement groups. The situation flared up after Israeli forces raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque and assaulted worshippers inside. Observers say Israel has declared war against Palestinians because they have dared to resist its colonial projects and demand freedom. However, amid its failure to silence the Palestinians during its aggression against Gaza, Israel escalates mass arrests, thinking it might bring them to their knees. Mona Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
The war of words between former top aide Dominic Cummings and the British Prime Minister has intensified. In a volley of tweets on the weekend, Cummings described Britain's early plan to combat the coronavirus pandemic as a disaster. Perhaps the most contentious of his allegations, the Johnson government's initial official strategy in March last year to achieve herd immunity without a vaccine. In other words, to let the virus rip through the population in order for people to build natural immunity, an allegation the government denies.
And you now admit as government that herd immunity was the policy until March?
Not at all, no. Absolutely not. Our policy, from the outset, Andrew, the policy and the strategy...
So why is Dominic Cummings telling us that that's true?
Well, I can't speak for Mr. Cummings.
When he was fired last year, Cummings took a large amount of documents with him, allegedly proving his allegations. He will appear in the British Parliament on May 26, where he is expected to present what he has called crucial historical evidence.
But Dominic Cummings to come out now and say he doesn't... He believes this is a word, that was a word of rubbish and it was dangerous... begs the question, why didn't he say that now, when he was in the position advising the government?
But why has Cummings, who played an important role in Boris Johnson's successful 2019 election campaign and was also the architect of Britain's campaign to leave the European Union, lashing out at his former boss?
He feels extremely sore, having been sacked from his position as Boris Johnson's chief advisor. So I think there's a question of personal revenge does come into it. But how far does he really want to push this? Does he want to push it to is in danger of toppling Boris Johnson? I suspect not.
Three lockdowns, more than 128,000 deaths, and a deep economic slump since the start of the pandemic.